This episode of the Tide Capital Millionaire Podcast was brought to you by Black America, Inc., A $1 trillion Nation, by A.R. Morton. Black America, Inc. is a piece of literature that details and illustrates the socioeconomic solutions that Black Americans can implement in their communities today. Whether it be being captains of our own industries, creating our own political parties, or just learning how to strengthen our overall health and wealth, Black America, Inc. is what Black Americans and Americans in general need to get to the next level in 2017 and beyond. For too many years, we have been talking about the problems and not the solutions. For too many years, we've been pointing fingers at each other without talking about the solutions. This is why Black America, Inc. is important. If you're ready to build yourself up and rebuild your community, head on over to Amazon.com and order your copy of Black America, Inc., A $1 trillion Nation.
This is the Todd Capital Billionaire Podcast, episode 19. My name is Todd Millionaire, also known as Charles Oglesby. I'm the founder and the director of the Tide Capital Investment Club that now has 101 members. I'm also the founder of Tide Acquisitions and Tide Ventures, which is our crowdfunded venture capital firm. Thank you all for tuning in. The purpose of this podcast is to share the stories of successful African-American investors and business owners so people can see that business and investing are the true keys to financial success and generational wealth. With us again is Mr. Lance Pettyway. He is a member of our Tide Acquisitions Club. He's a very knowledgeable real estate guy. Every time he's on, we have a great conversation. So, I mean, welcome to the show again, Lance.
Hey, what's up, Internet? What's up, Charles?
So, you talked to me, I think it was last week, and you said that there was an issue that was really pressing on you and you wanted to discuss. And, I mean, I think it's definitely timely. A lot of people that we're talking to and working with, they're millennials, and so they're looking to buy their first home. And if you're doing something that's going to progress your wealth, it's important that you're strategic about it, you're intentional about it, you're informed about it, and you're making the best possible kind of move that you can make. And so with that, we want to discuss just the power of buying a multifamily home for your first purchase over a single-family home. So, I mean, Lance, can you go ahead and just kind of take it away and, I mean, explain to us your logic behind that stance?
Yeah, we all hear that the American dream is you get your job, you get your house, you marry your kids and all that. But a single-family house kind of is just a burden on your paycheck when you think about it in the long run. Yeah, it's something that you pay down equity on, but the market can crash, and now you have you're paying a mortgage for something that isn't worth as much. Whereas if the market was to crash and your house loses value, maybe you still have your tenants in there paying you the same exact rent, still paying down that house, and regardless of how the market is, your equity is still building, and possibly at the end of that, you own the house completely outright. So, in my opinion, going after a multifamily on your first deal is ideal, and you can get that single family house that you want, that picket fence that you imagine in your on your vision board, after you have some tenants in your duplex or townhouse that you house hack for a couple years.
So you use the term multifamily. I know a lot of people are familiar with just going and buying their 4-5 bedroom house, but can you explain what a multifamily property is?
Two units or more. So you have your duplexes on up to your 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 units. On your first house, most banks, their loans go up to 4 families. Not everywhere has fourplexes. Most places may have only duplexes. Some may have triplexes. But a duplex is definitely easy to find in most markets across the country.
And so then, I mean, you mentioned that they can rent it out to tenants. And what's great, what I like about multifamily is it kind of allows you to house hack. It also allows you, like, there's so many benefits just to multifamily investing because it effectively puts you in position to live for free, where you have your tenants paying your mortgage, and then you come out of pocket nothing. An even better situation is where you have your tenants paying your mortgage, and you have another tenant that's just paying you cash flow, and you still live for free. So I think that's so cool. Yeah. And I mean, I've had interviews with guests on this show I've listened to podcasts, and a lot of immigrants already do this. It just seems like, for some reason, and I'm not sure why it is, but the African-American community kind of lacks in that regard, and that's why this podcast is formed, to let people know that we can do the same exact thing. And I think the one thing that you're alluding to is the fact that you can still get this finance on an FHA loan. So you can still get your low down payment, your 3.5% down payment, but now you have a cash flowing asset.
And that's another thing. People don't even know that the 3% or 3.5% loans are out there. And those are loans where they're encouraging people to buy property. They're encouraging first-time homeowners to buy property. And some people don't have the 20% down on houses. And that's 20% is a lot of money, whereas a 3.5% down in some cases could be $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, $10,000, $12,000 to some people, and that can definitely get them into something. But people run the risk of these FHA loans. The limits are kind of high, and of course the banks aren't just going to give you free money. But if you got a $500,000 loan, you only put 3% down, the high payment, and if the market goes easy, you lose value in your health, you're paying a high payment, and your paycheck is suffering. Now you're stressed out at work, and you got to get a second job just to pay for a house that you thought was going to be your dream. Where if you go into this and say, hey, I'm going to go and get a $150,000 duplex, put 3.5% down, house act this for a year or two, get another tenant in here, now I have both sides running it out, getting a cash flow. That's an easy way to go on to financial freedom, which is something that we definitely try to teach people.
And not only do you have that cash flow, you also have the potential equity. It's like a double whammy. And then what I what a lot of people aren't doing, a lot of investors aren't doing, is, well, some people are just now starting to do that. I was learning this from my millionaire mentor. He was calling it residual land interest. And so what you want to do is, it's one thing to get cash flow, it's another to get appreciation, but there's a huge benefit in having somebody pay off your asset for you. And so if you rent your property at break even, and then you have somebody that's just paying your mortgage and paying your mortgage, in 15, 20 years, you're going to have a property that's paid off. And so what they effectively did was say, here's $200,000. You can either sell the property or you can take out a home equity line of credit. But it's a way to kind of create a hidden asset that a lot of people overlook. A lot of people are like, I want my money and I want it now. But what my mentor told me was like, you know, this is my pension. He's like, this is my 401k. He owns all this land that he's effectively land leased out. And so people have to pay him on his land lease every single year. Every single month, for that matter. He gets paid $3,500 a month because somebody is leasing his land. A lot of people don't even know you can do that. I didn't know you could do it. I'm still trying to figure out what a land lease is, but it's a lot of wealth just in being strategic and thinking. And one of the points that I wanted to kind of bring up, since we're talking about multifamilies, is a lot of times when people...
Let me jump in real quick. Yeah. This may be not what your guy is talking about, but on a sophisticated level, in Manhattan, some of these skyscrapers that go up, the people just own the buildings that they're building. Exactly. They don't necessarily own the land. Exactly. So he may own land that a Walgreens or something is on, and Walgreens is paying him a ton of money in rent because they decided to throw a Walgreens on a parcel that he owns. So that's what he can mean by land leases.
Absolutely. And you know what's really crazy about that is I was reading the Forbes a while back, and it was talking about Donald Trump, and it was detailing where his net worth is. And Donald Trump owns land leases as well. And so a lot of his wealth is just properties that he's kind of allowed somebody to build on top of, that he has a land lease, which is increasing his net worth. It's not putting cash in the bank. It's increasing his net worth. And a lot of moves that people make, they're making them for income. They're making them for what they have in their pocket right now. What they really need to aim for is that wealth. And wealth, a lot of times you don't see that wealth. A lot of times that wealth is just kind of accumulating on the sidelines because you own something that increased in value or decreased in value. Because think about it. Just like I said, if you have a property that's paid down over 15, 20 years, you have $200,000, but you also have $200,000 in net worth. So I think that's important. But one of the things I really want to encourage people to do is, I mean, you have these multifamilies, and kind of going back to immigrants, is what they do is they'll link up and it'll be like a mother and son. Or what this one guy that he just retired, and what he's doing is he's going and linking up with his daughter and her husband, and him and his wife are going to go buy a property jointly. Black people don't do that stuff, man. But yeah. They should.
No. But, no, yeah, we worry about like co-signing cars and things like that for people, where it's just like, hey, we should just worry about wealth.
Exactly.
And it's not even on a selfish get rich type of situation, but just have the money for security, for the future, legacy, power, respect, however you want it. Wealth long term is a ton of things that people don't know.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I was kind of telling my mom, because they're looking for a new car right now, and they have two cars that are perfectly fine. And so I'm saying, like, hey, if you guys are going to finance something, because think about it, I was telling, like, if you guys are going to finance something that's $50,000, $60,000 to get a brand new truck, your payment's going to be $1,200. But you can use that same leverage, because what they're going to do is they're going to use your debt to income. So they're going to say, can you afford $1,200? So either you're going to afford $1,200 to pay on a car that's going to depreciate as soon as you drive it off the lot. People are going to be hating on you anyway. Like, oh, they don't need that new car.
Yeah.
Or you can use that same $1,200 debt to income to buy a $200,000 condo, duplex, something that's going to produce cash flow for you. People have to flip the script. And you have to say, like, am I investing in something that's going to put money in my pocket or take money out of my pocket? And that kind of alludes to what you're saying earlier, and what kind of scares me about even getting a huge home, a $500,000 home in California, is you're effectively tying yourself to that job for the next 30 years. And for me, I hate working a job. I'm so glad that Todd Capital is starting to kind of get more traction, because, like, for me, I don't plan on working a job for the next however many years. And it's not because, like, I don't want to work for anybody. It's because you're limited when you work for somebody. They're only going to pay you as much as they're going to pay you. When you work for yourself, the sky is the limit. So
exactly, yeah.
Cool, man. So, I mean, tell me more about multifamilies. Tell me more about, your views on that.
I think, you know what? One thing I wanted to touch on, when we were just talking about the wealth, I was just reading a story about the family who owned the Wall Street Journal. And the grandfather, essentially, or great-grandfather, bought the paper back in the early 1900s with $2,500, knowing that this would create a legacy for his family that he never even met or would never even meet.
Wow.
So a lot of things we have to go into thinking a couple steps ahead, because that will formulate the correct plan for anybody to go about conquering what's in front of them. This guy, he knew that the Wall Street Journal needed to be there for 2017 when his great-great-great-great-granddaughter needed to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
So he made sure that his wealth went towards something that was going to be there later on. And we aren't really leaving our kids anything besides bad assets, whether it's cars or underwater homes that they can't rent out because of deferred maintenance and things like that. So if we went more business savvy, multifamily off the rip, then that could snowball into two or three duplexes. We're not telling you to become a mogul or anything, but those two or three duplexes will allow you to save a little bit more money. It'll allow you to invest a little bit more money. It'll allow you to live in a better neighborhood. It'll allow you to put your kids in a better situation. And that's how we have to view certain things going into it. Long-term, solution-driven.
Yeah. I like what you said in regards to doing something that your kids are going to inherit. And that's, I just actually got off a call for another podcast that I recorded, and we were having that conversation about LaVar Ball and how you have this thinking where people are saying, hey, like, he should just take the Nike money. Who's this guy think he is? Who's he think he is? And first and foremost, we uncovered that the fact that LaVar Ball is actually worth about $4 million. But aside from that, like, he's building something for his kids' kids' kids. And I think he said that. He's like, I want you to own something. I don't want you to be a highly paid employee. I don't want you to be somebody who's getting pimped out by these big corporations. I want you, because you are just as good, you are their equal. Nike is human. Yeah. Nike is not some mythical creature, although they name themselves after one. Nike is human just like you. You can build something just as big as Nike. It's not going to happen overnight, but Nike wasn't built overnight. And so it's like, people have to think generational. It's like, I forgot where that quote is, like, he said, think, that my pastor said, he said, think generational. My pastor's a huge generational thinker. My pastor started this church. He has his sons working behind him. They're going to inherit the church and their sons. And I don't know why, but we just tend to not think like that. And I think that's one of our biggest hindrances is like, if you're not thinking for people who are outside of you, you're going to play small. You're going to dim your light. You're going to just get by because there's nobody else counting on you. So, I mean, even with Big Baller Brand, what he's creating, they're leveraging one person's success, and they're going to turn it into something that they own instead of something that just his son benefits from.
Yeah, exactly. And I had a thought. I'm just like, hey, if he has that brand, you have a Kanye West, which says that he wants to design, and he wants to design all the athletic wear for Chicago high schools. And then you have somebody like a Damon John who took FUBU to how big he took it. If you take those three minds, the Big Baller Brand, it could become anything. Mm-hmm. We have the know-how. We have the skills. We just don't have the people facilitating the deals or facilitating or middle manning the partnerships, or somebody just saying, hey, how about you get in touch with this person and this person, and y'all have this conversation. Don't take the public's view on anything. You know what you want. Those people's ideas match. Y'all hang out together. If we stuck around with like-minded people focusing on the greater good, we can get a lot accomplished, kind of like Todd Capital. Everybody's kind of, it's solution-based, and you put together 101 people, even putting a dollar in, that's a lot further than we were complaining on Twitter.
Exactly.
And that's what we have to focus on.
And the beauty of Todd Capital, in my opinion, is that everybody has an equity stake in the company. It's not like you're just giving me money so I can go create my dreams. And that's one of my big gripes of just these GoFundMes and these whatever. It's like, if I'm going to contribute to something, I want an ownership stake in that. I want a say in that. And, I mean, I guess that's kind of the cool thing about being at a certain station in life, where you can just start creating what you want to see instead of complaining about what you want to see. But in regards to just thinking like ownership and longevity, that's one of the things that I realized. The guy that I work for, he's extremely wealthy. He is 70 years old. He does not have to work anymore. Every deal that he says that he does is for his, like, kids' kids, his grandkids, his great-grandkids.
Yeah.
Like, the guy is, it's like, we're so limited. I know people who retire early from the government and they go sit on the beach while their kids struggle. Like, I know people who just neglect their kids altogether. And it's like, we're losing. It has nothing to do with anybody else. It has everything to do with us. It's like, when are we going to realize, like, hey, we're the problem and the solution? Like, that's the great thing about being the problem, is you're the solution. So it's like, whatever action steps that you take is going to put you in place, as long as you take ownership. And so many people don't want to take ownership because they just don't want the responsibility that comes with taking ownership. So I don't know. I think that in regard to the LaVar Ball situation, one thing that I always say is, like, when you're an employee, Nike does all the creative thinking. When you own, he's going to do the creative thinking, and he gets to profit off of that creative thinking. He's going to find his alliances. He's going to find a company that wants to work with him and do the manufacturing for him. He might go direct to the source, man. He might pull the Phil Knight and just go around the connect. So I'm excited to see what he does, man.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, the next thing I want to touch on, and it's something I kind of discussed on Instagram, is just the power of talking to lenders. And for somebody who's looking to get started, it's important to just talk to people, because everybody that you talk to, for the most part, as long as you're doing more listening than talking, they're going to kind of put you up on game. And a long time ago, there was this guy on Instagram called Mr. Investor, and he told me, he said, hey, I need you to pull a list of like 100 people and 100 lenders and just start calling lenders and asking them their rates. And so, like, I was in law school at the time. I didn't have the time to do it. And I also was just kind of scared to call people. I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. But, like, now that I'm done, I started doing that. And what you realize is, like, lenders know everything you need to know. Like, they know the hot markets. They know where people are doing deals that work. They know, like, what you should be looking for. They know if it's a good deal, if it's a bad deal. And so, like, a lot of times we think that the lender is the adversary when they're really your partner. And, I mean, I've had lenders that have kind of told me, like, you don't want to do that strategy, do this strategy. You don't want to look here, do look here. And it really helps just to kind of get out and look people. Now what I'm going to do is I'm starting to kind of get out to these REI events. And I've been slacking on those. But, I mean, I feel like it's another one of those situations where, like, the first one you do is uncomfortable. And the second and third one is just kind of, it's second nature from then on. And the same thing with real estate. I mean, just with doing deals. I was listening to this really, really good podcast. I'm not sure if you listened to it. We could probably talk about that. But the Set for Life guy, I think that might be where you got the house hacking idea. Is that where you got that from? Right. That was a good interview, man.
I heard the interview, but I only heard half the interview.
Only heard half? What made you not want to go through with
it? Yeah, I only heard half. I tend to, Bigger Pockets guests tend to, they're very conservative. Even if I won't say they shoot small, but they're very conservative in what they do. And even house hacking, like, for instance, where I live at, there's a ton of 2, 4, 3, 6 unit houses. A two family house doesn't really cash flow enough to say that you're an investor. Mm. And cash flow is like maybe $180 a month. And then it's just like, you can just get another job for an extra $180 a month. Like you can literally do anything for an extra $180 a month.
You can drive Uber for $100 a month.
Exactly. But if you went and got maybe 50 units in duplexes and stuff like that, then maybe I want to hear from you. But otherwise, like, one of my favorite podcasts episodes, this guy had 35,000 units.
Wow.
Like, that's the guy I want to know from. Not the person with, like, 4, 5, 6 units, because, like, that's just buying a house. Like, you just own, like, I get you own something, but, like, I want to know the business. So, like, when they start talking, like, house hacking and things like that, it's like, all right, you're kind of conservative in what you're doing. I need more actionable business stuff, not just like cleaning toilets and things like that. Like, I know how to be a landlord.
That's one thing I like about you, man, because you 10X, man. And I think that this is another time of me learning from Lance to aim bigger. Because for me, like, I don't know if sometimes I am conservative or sometimes I'm more hesitant to, like, really put myself out there. But I think that a lot of times, like, I'll aim small because it's attainable instead of looking at something that's so big that I'll never get started or I'll never make any progress. So, I mean, what are some podcasts that you do like, that you listen to, that are aim a little bit higher than that?
I've been running back some old episodes that I haven't even listened to before. Whether it's like Old Capital, going back to the first Old Capital Lending podcast, going back to their first episodes, or Real Estate Investing for Cash Flow with Kevin Bupp, and going back to his old episodes, because he's on 150 episodes right now. Dancing Around, the Best Real Estate Ever podcast with Joe Fairless. And I kind of read the titles and see what people are really doing.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll Google the guests or something like that. But I want to hear, like, big. One thing I wanted to touch on that I lost my train of thought on earlier. House flipping. I hate that. black people tonight.
I don't even listen to the episode of House Slippers, man. I skip past those.
One thing I wanted to touch on before, and I lost my train of thought. Black house ownership in 2017 is lower than it was before segregation.
Wow.
I mean, before segregation was ended. So when life was technically horrible for black people own more land in America than they do right now.
Wow.
And that's kind of because during the 2000s, when house prices were kind of going up crazy, black people were buying houses in neighborhoods that they grew up in, or predominantly black neighborhoods, and those were kind of hit the worst during the crash.
Mm-hmm.
So they were left holding horrible loans, a ton of property, and flipping left a bad taste in everybody's mouth. But to me, flipping is just another job. Like, you can't not check on your flips. You can't sit back and have your flips on autopilot. No matter how many systems you have in place or how many flips you've done, it's still a job, because your GC or your contractors can screw you regardless.
Yeah.
And things happen on flips, foundation issues, and most people just want to get in and out of flips. My thing is, you don't know what's behind the wall, how people left it. It may look good on paper, but it may be a horror show once you get there.
Mm-hmm.
So flipping is something that people should just stay away from. Like, cash flow is great. Get multifamily. Only worry about multifamily. Flip houses once you're rich and you start building spec homes. But other than that, house flipping is literally the worst possible thing you could do.
Interesting. It's kind of like the red ocean theory, and I think that a lot of the reasons why I kind of stay away from flipping is because I think that it's so hot. Like, television hyped it up, made everybody want to become a flipper, and so now there's really no opportunity to be flipped out there. Everything, for the most part, is priced at market. If you do find a deal, the contracts are going to eat up your profit. You won't be able to sell it.
Exactly.
I'm not a fan. One thing that I do like, though, and one thing I still am kind of focusing on, is flipping high-end real estate. Only because a lot of times you can find a deal in an area that's in high demand, and you can get it for a good price. You can create a lot of value just by creating something ultra-luxury that somebody with the money is going to pay for. Like in Newport Beach, Costa Mesa, those very high-end Orange County areas where people have money. That's the only place that I would really see flipping, but I wouldn't even consider that a flip, which is interesting. But
yeah, building spec homes is where I think the only way that you should flip. Like in my area right now on the market is a ton of old houses. All the new houses are kind of snapped up in certain areas, and it's just like, the old houses are at market, so even if you bought them to flip them, you would have to charge so much, and there's just not enough people looking for newly constructed houses at those high, high prices. But you have a ton of old people downsizing, dying, and things like that, leaving houses from the 80s, 70s, 60s, 90s, even the early 2000s that need to be totally gutted for millennials or just a way of living in 2017. So flips are possible, yes, but finding the deals to flip is a lot harder than scrolling the MLS and going, hey, I'm going to buy that house and transform it, because you end up losing your shirt. And even renting things, you wouldn't be able to rent it because there's a ton of new inventory in the market.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's kind of crazy. You have to find the new market. And I think that you have to find a niche that's not being served. And I think that's kind of why what I want to do and what I think I want to focus on is just providing affordable housing. And I said so many times, it's like, if you can provide affordable housing that people can afford to own, not rent, there's probably profit just in creating that solution for somebody. However you have to creatively create that solution, that's where the money is in real estate right now. And I think if you've noticed, that's what it seems like the guy on, I think, I forget his name, Darnell or whatever, the developer and the...
Yeah.
It seems like that's all he's focusing on is affordable housing. And it's so crazy because when I reached out to him on the internet, people who don't know who that is, very successful developer. He's connected to... What was that guy, the other guy's name?
Quentin Primo. You're talking about Daryl Carter.
Exactly. So Quentin Primo, super wealthy, kind of like a Don Peebles type guy. He was connected to Daryl Carter. And I emailed Daryl Carter, and I wanted to provide value to the relationship. And so I just, like, gave him all my ideas, dope ideas. I was like, hey, you need to do affordable housing this way, and you can do it this way. And if you don't want to do it that, you can do this. And now he's out there raising funds to do deals that I think are pretty much my deals. But maybe what I should have done, because I ended up not getting that lunch, which kind of pissed me off. But what I should have done is just like told him I have this idea that you might be interested in, and then meet for lunch, and then give him the idea, and then he knows me face to face instead of just like shooting everything up through LinkedIn.
Affordable housing is a lot more than people think. Like, affordable housing used to be the project in a lot of people's eyes. Now affordable housing is everybody's house, basically, because most people are living in things that they can't afford. And so focusing on, and one of the his last properties that he bought, like, the rent was like $1,500. To some people, that's unaffordable. So focusing on things that people can pay for will always drive demand. And it doesn't matter the shiny objects that you put in the buildings, but if people can't pay for them, then they can't live in it.
Yeah. I think that a lot of what the market's doing right now, building all these luxury apartment complexes, is misguided. And it wouldn't be the first time that they've done that and been misguided. I'm actually reading that Don Peebles book right now, and he was saying that a lot of what caused the recession that he came into was the fact that there was so much inventory on the market that what they have to do is start discounting the property in order to actually get it filled. And I think you showed me an article where they were showing that, like, rents are starting to decrease. That's only in certain areas, and Southern California, Orange County rents look like they're going up. But I think that just in what I've seen in, like, downtown LA, like, they're going to have to start bringing those rents down. And I think I am seeing the rents go down because I had a conversation with somebody on this podcast a while back, and they were talking about how rents continue to go up. But I was looking at all the new builds because they're building so much inventory in downtown LA trying to kind of just redevelop everything that it's going to have to become more realistic. I always tell people that if millennials can't afford to buy your homes, they're overpriced.
I have a thought, and actually, I never even said it. I've been thinking this. I never even said it out loud to flesh the whole idea out. But the biggest problem right now isn't the things that are coming on the market that are high priced. It's based on wages having grown.
Yes.
So what we earn now are kind of like what our parents earned before, but for them, like, they bought them a house and a car, and they could afford to keep us alive, where we can't do that now.
Yep.
And so we live in a housing shortage. We need, like, 300, some people say 400,000 units to come online every year to keep everybody fully housed. Now, that's not happening. In some cases, it is. In most cases, it's not. So even though the Class A people have to go and give concessions and free rides and Bentleys and maid service for a year, things like that, it's just because people can't afford it.
Yeah.
People want it. They just can't afford it because their jobs aren't paying them enough. So if wages start to go up, you will see people spend differently when it comes to housing or being able to afford a house or rent. I think it has a lot to do with wages.
I'm glad you bring that up because that's actually an idea that I was entertaining as well. Because, I mean, you look at these multifamily properties, you look at properties that are kind of being sold right now, whether they're single-family homes or what have you. And I'm thinking that if the market goes up, the only thing that's going to help push those properties up in value is if wages increase. And I think that that's one of Donald Trump's main initiatives is kind of helping wages increase. And that's one thing that I've been seeing. My mom's works at a CPA firm. I work for a family office. And when I'm seeing a lot of people leaving for higher wages, and I think that when we're in the recession, people just wanted a job. They just like, I need a job. And now that we have some stability, people are like, okay, now I already know I'm going to have a job. Now I want to be paid what I'm worth. And I think that there's a lot of, we just saw Apple has like $256 billion on the sidelines. Like, there's going to be money that's coming back from overseas. There's going to be money that's going to be coming back to companies through the decreasing taxes. That's going to allow them to pay more wages. And I think that you're absolutely right. That's something I've been thinking about as well. And I think that that kind of gives you some comfort because, I mean, for me, as an investor looking at a lot of these properties that the cap rates are so low on, if the cap rate is low, but then the property increases in value or your rents go up in value, it tends to kind of justify you holding that property because then you have equity or then you can increase the rents, which increases the cash flow, all that stuff. So,
yeah,
you're absolutely right. I think that you're spot on, man. I like that.
Yes, sir.
So I think that should give people some comfort just if they're looking to invest. Did you have any last words? I know you're reading this book I wanted to get you to talk about called, what was it called? The 3G Capital book?
The 3G Capital book, but actually I've been skipping around. I haven't read that in a while. I've been kind of interested in seeing how people raise capital. And then another corporate takeover I kind of just started was Rupert Murdoch and the Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. And something like that, I just kind of want to know what rich people do. I don't really care about how the company was bought. I just want to know what's the tactics that the lawyers use. Mm-hmm. How did the grandfather set up the family trust to keep his family alive for centuries that he didn't even know would come to exist? I'm more of I want to know the technical things because I don't even know how I'm going to use them in my world domination plan.
I like man.
I mean, kind
of, you need to join my mastermind group. Why aren't you a part of my mastermind group, man? I need people who think like that. I was listening to this podcast a while back, and she was talking about how, like, she would meet with her group and talk about how they're going to dominate the world. And, like, it sounds so stupid, but she's, like, dumb successful. And, like, those talks are good, man. It's like, we need to figure out how are we going to dominate the world. Like, and I used to think that before I heard her kind of legitimize my thoughts. Like, you got to join the mastermind group. I'm sending you an invite today.
Yes.
Definitely going to make it happen.
Yeah, people are thinking about it. And even if it's, like, a cheesy, like, oh, one day I'm going to take over XYZ. If you tell yourself that enough, you're going to create the opportunities for yourself to be in that position to take over XYZ. Yeah. It may seem far-fetched now, but 10 years from now, you're going to be like, yo, I said I was going to dominate the delivery ice cream business, and now I'm the number one deliverable ice cream company. Like, if you say it enough, it's going to come to you because you're going to create the situations that you need to be in.
Yeah, I always tell my mom, like, that's the power of setting goals. It's like you set these goals, and then as you go out, you just start drifting to things that are going to help you get closer and closer to that goal. You're going to start watching certain things on TV. You're going to start reading certain things, talking to certain people, going to certain conferences, studying different things that are going to help you get there. And, I mean, it just makes too much sense. I definitely abide by that. I've lived a lot of my life by that, just like having that vision every year. I make a vision board. Doing those, what do they call those, affirmations, just building it up, like, pressing towards the mark.
A lot of people, so one thing that I can tell people, and it's kind of been a message I said to a couple people this week, you can make yourself into whoever you want to be. Mm-hmm. A couple of things I picked up in a few podcasts and a few stories I've read, a lot of people, they know that they want to become successful, but they aren't that person. And they may have gotten in trouble in the past, or their personality type just doesn't fit where they see themselves at in the future. And one day they just say, I'm going to change. I'm going to cut my hair. I'm going to wear a suit every day. I'm going to start going to real estate investor meetups. I'm going to do different things to get my life in order to go on that path. And you may not see yourself there, but, like, just change your life about face and put yourself in that position, and you can create the opportunities and the success that you need.
DJ Khaled would say, I like that. And that's where we're going to end this episode. I mean, it's always a pleasure talking to Lance. Probably going to try to do this like once a week, man. Just talking about real estate, talking about different things that we learn, bringing on some guests to help to kind of have them kind of add value to the conversation. If you are interested in joining any of the things that we have going on, you can email us at info@capitaltodd.com. That goes for the investment club. That goes for the investment club for real estate. That goes for Todd Ventures. That goes for anything. You can also get any information on their website at capitaltodd.com. We appreciate you for listening. This is Todd Capital signing off.